Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon to take your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, these are the subjects we will discuss. Actually, anything that's of interest to or concern to Christians, we can you can call and ask about. But you can also call if you disagree with the host and see things differently. We'd be glad to hear from you. The number to call is 844-484-5737. And it looks to me like the line's just filled up, and that means if you call right now, you'll probably get a busy signal. But lines will be opening. They open up throughout the show. So keep this number on hand, 844-484-5737, and call when you hear that a line is open, which you will know it has when we've ended up talking to somebody and they move along, then their line is open. Right now, we have a call from Lacey, Washington, coming from Ron. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Ron. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. Now,
hi.
Matthew 18, verses 15 to 19, Jesus gives the church a four-step outline to follow when sin infiltrates the church. And then in verse 18, he authorizes the church judges to bind and loose by using a perfect passive neuter plural participle. So the question is, what does the perfect mean?
Perfect means it has already happened. And verse 18, where it says, assuredly, I say to you, now many translations read it like the one I'm looking at, which is the New King James, but it's inaccurate. They read it, assuredly, I say to you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. But it's actually a passive perfect tense, which means that it's it should go like this. Whatever you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. In other words, the way it reads in most English translations, though not all, it sounds like it's saying that you bind something on earth and God will then bind it in response to you doing that. He'll bind it in heaven so that heaven will kind of stand behind your decisions you make here on earth with reference to binding and loosing. Actually, in the Greek, it reads differently. It's rather that we are supposed to stand behind the decisions that have been made in heaven, that whatever we bind on earth will have already been bound in heaven. And whatever we loose on earth will already have been loosed in heaven. And that simply means, I think, it means that the church is to be mindful of what heaven, which is, of course, a euphemism for God himself, things what God has himself determined, the church is supposed to stand for and, as it were, enforce in its ranks on earth. So that what this is basically saying is we need to stand with God about things like this. If someone is an unrepentant sinner and you've taken him through the various steps that Jesus lists there, finally you've taken him before the church and they won't hear the church either, then Jesus, you need to treat them as if they're a tax collector or a heathen, which is simply a way of saying you don't associate with them. You treat them as if they're not part of the body of Christ. And in doing so, you are not taking upon yourself some kind of an illegitimate prerogative. Like people say, well, who are you to judge? You know, how can you excommunicate this person? Nobody's perfect and so forth and so on. Who are you to do this? Jesus is saying, well, the things that are already bound and loosed in heaven, that is, the decisions God has already made in heaven, are to be, in fact, enforced on earth, bound and loosed on earth. And this would be suggesting that this person clearly is not a Christian. If he was a Christian, he would have repented under the several generous opportunities he'd been given. But he's insisting on defying the entire church and continuing in his sin. Therefore, God is declaring this person not a Christian, and you should regard him as not a Christian too, so that the church then decrees to be so what God has already decreed to be so. And it, of course, what it means is, insofar as the church is doing that, if someone says, well, who made you a judge over us? Well, Christ has. Christ has authorized the church to stand for what he stands for. And therefore, in other words, we don't take personal responsibility for the decisions that God has made. We just repeat them. We just, stand by them. We just enforce them, as it were, in our Christian community. So that is what I think that is referring to. Perfect tense means it's already been done.
working that closely with God certainly is an awesome authority that he gives us. Now, in the verse 19, he goes on to promise that the Heavenly Father will answer the prayers of the church judges, peri pantos pragmatos. Well, what does pragma mean?
I'm sorry, whatever he says in verse 19?
Yeah.
He says, where two or more of you agree on earth concerning...
Peri pantos pragmatos. So what does pragma mean?
I don't know what pragma means. I'm not a Greek scholar. Which word is that translating?
Well, pragma
is, it will be done?
Is a very neutral, all-inclusive term. It's like the var in Hebrew, and it's like the word we have in English where we say thing. So it's a thing, it's a matter, it's an affair. It covers a lot of territory. Like
okay,
that.
So concerning any pragma, anything, that's right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I suppose this is probably to be taken in the context of what he's been discussing, that if the church... leaders, and he is talking to the church that he's talking to the apostles, actually. He said if two of them agree as touching anything, it will be done. I suppose it means, with reference to these kinds of decisions that are being made, if the church is in agreement about it, then God stands by it.
Now, in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 1, the Holy Spirit expounds upon that authority of the church judges by repeating that word, pragma. And since epi with a genitive means before or by, here's the question. Before whom and only by whom does God command the believers to be judged?
I'm sorry, that sentence is not a simple sentence. What are you asking?
No, it's not. Paul put a lot into it.
Okay, in 1 Corinthians 6, 1, Paul said
chapter 6, verse 1.
Okay, 1 Corinthians 6, 1, Paul said that if people have disputes with each other, he's saying that they shouldn't be going to the secular courts. They should have this decided by some, as he puts it, some wise one among them. Who could judge between them, so that, in other words, the church's relational problems are not decided by secular pagans, but really by church, mature Christians in the church. So what is your question about that?
So the question is, God commands us to go before somebody, epi, as what it means before, to be judged, but by whom? Does God say we must be judged?
Well, he says in verse five, I say to this to your shame, is it so that there is not a wise man among you, not even one, who will be able to judge between his brethren? Now, he certainly isn't suggesting that there's clergymen involved in this decision. He said you need a wise brother. Is there a wise man in the church who can judge this matter? He doesn't indicate that it's a matter for church clergy. It's a matter for wise Christians to be able to help sort out things that are standing as barriers in the relationship between two Christians who have, a complaint against each other. When two people have a complaint against each other, they often are not seeing both sides very clearly. Mainly they're seeing their own side. And so sometimes, instead, he's saying don't go to court about it, but find a wise man in the church who can, make a judgment about this. He's not really talking about the person in the church making a legal judgment like a court would make, but rather he's assuming Christians are people who want to do the right thing. They just sometimes can't see clearly enough. And so you need a wise Christian who can see more clearly than you can to sort it out, to mediate between two people with a problem. That's what I think Paul's talking about. What is it that you think he's talking about? Because obviously... you've done a lot of thinking about this. You've even looked it up in the Greek and all of that. So what is it you're trying to get at with these questions?
Well, actually, you were a step ahead. You picked up the next question is, what are the capabilities of these church judges? And you got them both. They're sophos, which means wise, and they're nephetai to akrinai. Akrinai means...
who can judge.
To differentiate precisely. And that term is used 19 times in the New Testament, five times.
Okay, so I guess my question for you is, what is your question for me?
Oh, Well, the last question would be, if somebody wanted to learn about church judges today in the USA, who would they contact?
Church judges? Uh-huh. I don't know. I don't know if we have any church judges, but there are mediation ministries out there that, you know, if there are people who will mediate, who are Christians, it shouldn't be necessary to go outside your local church to find someone to mediate a problem. It should be mediated within the church if possible. But Paul's amazed that the Church of Corinth doesn't have even one wise person in it who can do that. But it shouldn't be that unusual to find a wise person in the church, hopefully several, who could, you know, would be able to help people through this kind of a difficulty. Let me ask you this. Is your question coming from a Roman Catholic position?
No.
Okay. Because I know that my friend Tom, the Roman Catholic who calls me, often brings these things up as if to say you really need a centralized authority in the church to settle disputes. And I thought maybe that's where you're going with it. I'm not sure where you're going with it. Do you have a dispute with another brother or sister and you're looking for mediation?
No, I am the pastor of the church judges in the USA. And so that I would be the person to call to find out more about that. And my number is 253-203.
All right. Well, I appreciate your call. So, in other words, you called to advertise your ministry. Okay, well, you could have been more forthright about that. I appreciate your call today. Let's talk to, Hunter from Alabama. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Hunter.
Hey, how you doing, Steve?
I'm well, thanks.
Good. What is your opinion on divorce? I have a pastor, a friend of mine that I look up to a lot, and he's going through a recent divorce. You know the guy that I'm talking about, Ken Hogan. He went through a divorce. He got falsely put in prison for 9 years, and then he came out. His wife wanted to leave him, and he's having problems with his kids. Well, he met this woman and decided to get married to her. And so a lot of people are criticizing him for that. What are your opinions on when is it appropriate to have a divorce?
Okay, Hunter, let me just say this. Either my headphones or your phone is not doing very well. And I think I made out most of what you said, but your voice is kind of phasing in and out, which makes it very difficult. You mentioned Kent Hovind. And you mentioned something that I think I'm not aware of. Did you say he filed for divorce?
No, his wife filed for divorce.
His wife filed for divorce. Okay, see, I couldn't quite make out what you're saying. So why did she do that? Because he was in prison?
Yeah, because when he was in prison, he was in prison for 9 years, and she said that basically, I don't know all the details of what he's told me and from other sources that are close to him. They just said that his wife basically just didn't want to do it just after that being that long without, you know, having him around and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of lost feelings or lost the desire to be with him anymore. So she filed a divorce. Well,
is he still in prison or is he out now?
Oh, my bad. I'm sorry. I don't know what's going on. Can you hear me better now?
Maybe a little bit, but I just asked you, is he out of prison now?
Yes, he's out of prison. He's been out of prison for about 8 years.
Okay.
And he decided to get remarried, and people are you know, being judgmental about that. So what are
my opinion is that if his wife has divorced him, and she's remained single and has not been with another man, then her divorce is not valid and his is not valid. Now, if one of them were sleeping with somebody else, then I believe the other one would have valid grounds for divorce. So, I mean, if she has had other men or if she's gotten married again, then I would say that she has broken the marriage covenant by doing that and that he would be then free to remarry. That would be my opinion. Now, if she has not been with another man, if she's not remarried, then I think he should be striving for reconciliation, because there's actually been nothing that creates a valid grounds for divorce if neither of them has been unfaithful. In other words, if a woman gets tired of waiting for her husband because he's in prison, that's not the same thing as grounds for divorce. Now, if he's in prison for murder or something like that, if he's actually done something worthy of death, according to Scripture, and a situation in which, if the Scriptures were followed, he would have been put to death, she would have been free from the marriage in any case, and that might be viewed differently. But Kent Hovind was not imprisoned for doing any great crime. It was, as I understand it, for alleged tax evasion, and and it was a matter of conscience with him. I'm not saying he did the right thing. I don't know the law, and I don't know his what he did as well as some people do. But from what I understand it, it was a matter of tax evasion where he believed, on biblical grounds, that he was in the right, and the state decided that he was not, and they slapped a really heavy sentence on him because they don't like him being, you know, a leading creationist voice or whatever. This is at least how it's been represented to me. I haven't followed the case. But in any case, he wasn't put in prison for murder or for, you know, some grievous crime.
Can I just say this? Yeah. What he's told me is he's personally told me that he's done everything he knows to do to reconcile the marriage. And to he's tried for months and months, and she just continually putting him down and saying, no, I don't want this, I don't want this. He said he's done everything he knows to do. He's prayed and prayed and prayed.
Well, there is one more thing. There's one more thing he can do, and that is wait. To try for months and months, you know, and have his wife say no for months and months is not definitive. There are people who've been whose husbands or wives have left them, and they've remained separate for years, with one of them wanting to reconcile and the other one not being the least bit interested. And then God changes something in their heart, and then they are reconciled. You know, I don't think that a marriage is broken up just because one party's decided they don't want it anymore. There's a covenant that was made before God and man that they would stay together until one of them is dead, and neither of them is dead yet. So they should keep their promise. Now, the one thing that I know that Jesus mentioned that could nullify the obligations of that would be if one of them was now sexually joined to an outsider, to somebody outside the marriage.
Well, he just got remarried this past weekend, and I my heart longs for him because, like, I don't know, that's a difficult situation. Biblically, it might not be the 100% correct thing to do, but I do see from the point of view of, hey, once you've done all you can do, and you pursued it, and as far as he got evicted from his own house,
I'll just tell you, I myself, I like Kent Hovind just fine. I don't have anything against him, but lots of Christians make decisions about that I think are wrong, and that is, I believe, a wrong decision to say that I tried for months or even for years, and she just doesn't want to talk to me about it right now. Is not the same thing as waiting to see if God will work in the situation. It is a marriage, after all. When you marry somebody, you're in a marriage. You're one flesh. It's not just somebody says, I'm tired of being one flesh, so we're done. Well, maybe you're done if she goes out and becomes one flesh with somebody else. For example, when my wife divorced me, she didn't want to talk to me. She didn't want to be in the same room with me. I never even heard why she left. She just left without, any explanation. I don't even know why, even to this day. And that was 15 years ago. But at the same time, I would not remarry or consider it until it turned out that she remarried. When she remarried, I figured, okay, well, that's done, you know. But I actually was holding out hope that she would change her mind. Now, she didn't. But I know of many cases like mine where the wife did change her mind and come back to her husband, or vice versa. So you never know what God's going to do. As long as the thing has not been broken, the marriage has not been broken biblically, then God does not yet see it as a broken marriage. It may be a marriage that's damaged, but not broken.
I got one more question for you.
Okay.
And it's actually a Bible question. On Romans chapter 6, verses 8 through 14, our preacher of the church, he did a message on this passage, and his argument scripturally is about how, in a way, it was about how you witness to people. And he brought up the fact that Paul is throughout the book of the book of Romans up to this point, he's made the argument of how to evangelize. You know, the gospel is just very, very gospel, you know, enforced, the gospel reinforced it. And then now, when you flip over to chapter 6 and you get here to verse 8 through 14, he then says, okay, now that you've accepted Christ and you've gotten these things down, here's some principles to live by or some instructions. So do you think that should change how Christians present the gospel to people instead of just trying to hit them with do's and don'ts and moral issues, you know, moral reasons to morality, or should we just push the gospel, you know,
I'm not getting at all what it is that this particular preacher is saying. I mean, from what you said, it's not obvious to me what he is saying about verses 8 through 14, but it does sound like he has some differences of opinion from my own on the whole structure of the book of Romans. Lots of people think, as he apparently does, that the book of Romans is telling you how to witness to unbelievers and that it's about, you know, just presenting the gospel so that people will be saved. My understanding is that the book of Romans is like the other epistles. It's not written to get people saved. It's written to people whom he calls saints. He says all the saints in Rome. So these people are already saved. I don't think he spends any time trying to talk to them about how to get saved. I think that most of the early chapters of Romans, he's dealing with a problem that exists in the church between the Jewish attitude and the Gentiles' attitude toward one another. That I think there's a problem between the Jews and the Gentiles, that Paul begins to address it in the opening chapter and is still working on it through chapter 7 at least. In fact, probably still through chapter 11. So in other words, I believe we've got a different paradigm of what Romans is about. Now, you say when we talk to people about the Lord, should we not talk to them about morality or something? It sounds like that's what you're saying. And again, your phone is kind of phasing in and out. In fact, it's not even a good enough quality for radio. I'm sure my listeners are having the same problems I'm having understanding what you're saying. But I don't think that when we witness to people that our message is about morality. I think our message is about Jesus. Now, of course, Jesus being king is part of our message. Him being Lord is the centerpiece of our message. And if he's the Lord and the king, then obedience to him is, inseparable from the core of the message, that we're calling people to be submissive to the true king, to submit to him, to surrender, to stop rebelling and to follow him and be obedient to him. Now, that definitely has moral ramifications. But I don't believe that our message, if what you're talking about morality, if we're going out and talking to, drunkards about the sin of drunkenness, or we're talking to homosexuals about the sin of homosexuality or something like that, I don't think that's how the gospel is presented anywhere in Scripture. I think that the unbeliever can be expected to live in sin. They're a slave of sin, and therefore to go in to preach them that they should stop getting drunk or stop doing their bad things, that's expecting a rock to produce blood. They can't do that. They have to be saved. They have to come to Christ. They have to surrender their life to Jesus Christ as the king, and then his spirit will be given to them, and then we can definitely expect them to begin to live differently, because Christians, by definition, live differently. Jesus said, by this all men will know that you're my disciples, if you have love one for another. And that's love is a way of living. And so the way a Christian lives is different than the way a non-Christian lives. And certainly has moral ramifications. And if a person's living immorally, then they're not living as a Christian. But if a person's not a Christian, and we go out and start, you know, confronting them about their moral life, I don't see that we're doing them much good. They know as well as we should know that they can't stop doing what they're doing. They need to be saved. They need to be rescued. His name should be called Jesus because he'll save his people from their sins. Well, why should they need to be saved from their sins? Because they can't save themselves from them. They can't stop sinning. They're a slave. And so we're preaching Jesus, the deliverer and the Lord, the new king. And once they have embraced him in that role, then we can expect some change in their life. In fact, not only expect it, but God demands it. I hope that may be helpful, Hunter. But yeah, I was having a real hard time understanding almost every word you said. Maybe, I know you call from time to time. Make sure that you call from a phone that has a good connection, please, because it's we're on the radio and it's really hard to require our listeners to struggle through a long question that's not very clear. First of all, not very clearly stated, but then secondly, not very clear on the phone. We need some. Remember, when you're on the radio, think of other people. I mean, I know you didn't know the quality of your phone was not as good, but anyone, I'm just to anybody out. If you're on the radio, realize there are thousands of people wanting to hear something worth hearing from you and hopefully from me. And so state it clearly. We've had a few callers already today who've kind of meandered a long time before it was ever evident what their call was even about. If you call a program with a question, this is a Q&A program, unless you want to call to disagree, you're welcome to do that. But please do so succinctly and clearly and state what your question is as quickly as possible, okay, because we do have our lines mostly full. And by the way, we do have one line open right now. If you'd like to call, you're listening to The Narrow Path. The number to call is 844-484-5737. All right, our next caller is Brooke calling from Sacramento, California. Brooke, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for being here and answering these questions for us. And I do want to say quickly that you sharing your life and some of your challenges and difficulties really helps us, out here.
Thank you.
Yes, it makes us feel connected as a Christian, you know, that others suffer and have some of the same problems, challenges, et cetera. But that brings me to my question. I'm having a hard time myself, and Jesus said, with God, all things are possible. And I feel that's not true, because when you lose someone very dear to you through death, they are not coming back in this lifetime, no matter how much you want them to come back and be with you again. It appears in the Bible that that's just not possible. And when Jesus says, with God, all things are possible,
Have you lost a loved one recently?
Yes.
I'm sorry. You know, I had a wife who died also. I've lost wives both ways. But I'm really sorry to hear that you're going through that. But I would say this. Jesus said all things are possible. He didn't say all things are guaranteed. It's true. There is no guarantee that anyone will see their dead loved ones again in this life, although it's not impossible. It's just pretty unusual. I think the Bible does show it is not impossible, because when Lazarus died, his sisters thought for sure it was too late. And they said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And Jesus said, well, he's going to live again. And they said, well, yeah, I know, at the resurrection of the last day. He says, no, just watch. And he raised him from the dead. In fact, Jesus raised a number of people from the dead, but that's pretty unusual. And and I don't know of very many people who've been raised from the dead. I knew one woman who died with a tubal pregnancy in her bathroom. They took her to the hospital. She'd been dead for a while, but she came back. And she actually said that she'd seen Jesus and asked him, you know, could she go back and raise her children who were young? And he said she could. Now, you hear stories like that once in a while. This is actually a case of someone I know and respect, and I know she was dead. You know, so, I mean, you don't know for sure that God won't send somebody back, but I don't think it happens in one of a million cases. When my wife was killed in an accident in 1980, one of the women in the church thought that the Lord told her that God wanted to raise my wife from the dead. Well, I didn't know whether God spoke to her or not. He didn't tell me that, but a group of people from the church wanted to gather around the casket and pray for that. And they did, and she didn't rise from the dead. And it wasn't, of course, any surprise to me, frankly, because I didn't have a word from the Lord about it. And I didn't particularly think she would rise from the dead, but there were some people there who might have had enough faith to think so. In any case, when someone dies, I don't expect them to rise from the dead. I don't expect that to happen until the resurrection. But I know that God can. Nothing is really impossible. But if we think that he is meaning nothing that we want will be denied us, well, then of course that isn't true. Many things we want will be denied us. It doesn't mean that if we have enough faith, it'll be possible for us to make anything happen we want, including have our dead relatives, you know, spring back to life. That's not what it means when he said, with God, nothing is impossible. What it means is if God intends to do something, there's nothing he can't do. But it doesn't say that he wants to raise people from the dead prior to the resurrection. In fact, it would appear that he mostly doesn't. Christians have to face the loss of loved ones as all people do. In fact, I was just reading today C.S. Lewis's book, A Grief Observed. Have you ever read that?
No, I haven't. I might write that down.
Yeah, are you familiar with C.S. Lewis?
Yes, I am, and I've kind of studied his life, too.
Yeah, his wife, you know, died of cancer. And he struggled with that. And he wrote a brief book, four chapters long. It's very, very deep, very deep musings. And he almost, you know, in the beginning, it sounded like he was kind of on the verge of maybe losing his faith over it. He's just wrestling with God over the matter. And then he comes out better at the end. But I mean, this was written in process, you know, and he didn't write this afterward looking back at it. These were his journals he was taking weeks after she died and with the struggles he was going through. It's called A Grief Observed. And it's a real small book. If you buy it, it'll probably be, you know, in a collection with other books of his or whatever, too, because it's such a small thing. But I think it might be of use to you.
Yes, I am familiar with that story. And he did pray for her. And she did live some years beyond that, as I understand.
Yeah, she had what looked like a miraculous remission, but then it came back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And after praying and praying with my situation, that did not happen. And, you know, so it's been a little discouraging and trying to find something to kind of hang on to here, you know.
Could I ask you, was it your husband who died?
No.
A child?
It's hard to talk about. I start getting kind of emotional.
Okay.
But
it's
very difficult.
All right. Well, you know, when my wife died, you know, I didn't have a chance to pray for her to get better because she died suddenly. She was hit by a truck. She was walking, got hit by a truck and was killed instantly. So I didn't get to watch her die slowly and didn't have a chance to pray for her to get better and things like that. She was healthy. Thanksgiving morning, which was November 27th, 1980, she went for a walk with my 7-year-old daughter and didn't come home alive. She was hit by a truck and was killed instantly. So, but, you know, people, you know, that was hard. That was hard for me.
But
it was not as hard as it might otherwise have been because I do believe that with God all things are possible. And I do believe that God, had he wished, could have prevented that from happening. The Bible does talk about the angels of the Lord encamping about those who fear him and delivering them. And she was definitely a God-fearing woman. She loved the Lord. So I know that he could have delivered her. He had all the resources necessary. If he didn't, then I believe he had a good purpose in letting her come home. I mean, that's how I see it. When people say, well, you know, didn't you struggle with being angry with God or something? That's something I never had any struggles with at all. I have to honestly say, it never occurred to me that I should be angry at God because I knew when I married her that she was going to die. I didn't know when she would die, but I knew she was a human being and human beings die. And so, you know, I didn't know she would die at age 25. You know, I kind of might have hoped she would die at age 95. But in any case, whether she died at 25 or 95, dying is still a loss to me. And it would be a loss if she died at 95. It's not enjoyable to lose loved ones. But realistically, we should know that everyone we know, everyone in our home living with us, everyone who's not living with us, all our neighbors, all our best friends, our pastor, all our friends at church, they're all going to die. Every last one of them going to die, and we are too. And so I guess with me, one of the curiosities I have about myself is, when will I die? Am I going to live to be old, or am I going to die young, or whatever? And it's not a matter of caring. I don't care if I die old or young, since going to be with the Lord is far better, Paul said, and I certainly have always believed that. But I guess if I knew I was going to die, for example, if a doctor told me I had 3 weeks to live, I would almost feel kind of relieved. Oh, that removes the mystery. You know, I knew I was going to die sometime. I just didn't know when. Now I have the privilege that most people don't have of knowing that I'm going to die soon. And at least that gives people opportunity to prepare. Fortunately, my wife was prepared already, but she didn't expect to die at age 25. But she was ready to meet God.
And that's what I was alluding to before, that you sharing these things with us really helps tremendously. And when you just said, well, if the doctor said, I'm going to die in 3 weeks, you know, that there's times when you think, well, okay, if now's the time, fine, you know,
yeah.
Because you're in so much pain sometimes.
Sure.
But it really helps that you're there, Steve, and that you share all this with us. And
well, I'm very sorry for your loss. I know it's very difficult to go through, and I'm very sorry for that loss.
And thank you so much, and I'm sorry for your loss also. And thank you for being
God bless you, and I appreciate your call and your sharing your burden with us. God bless you.
Thank you so much. Bless you too.
Bye now. All right. And how many people may be out there going through that same thing? You know, as a matter of fact, this might be a good time for you to mention. I'm going to be coming up to Oregon and Seattle area and speaking in the next couple of weeks. Actually, I'll be up for the entire time from about the 6th of October until like the 16th of October, speaking in various venues in Oregon and Washington. All of them are listed at our website. But the reason I mention it right now is because in McMinnville, I have been asked to speak on the subject of the Christian's way of coping with grief. And the reason I was asked is because the man who invited me, he lost his wife in the past year. And he's a strong Christian. I'm sure he's doing just fine. But he just thought he'd like to hear about coping with grief as a Christian. And certainly the Bible tells us that that's a specifically Christian topic. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 4 that he wanted us not to be ignorant, lest we should grieve as others who have no hope do when they lose loved ones. So there is a distinctive way of Christian grieving that is appropriate, and I will be speaking about that. I'll be speaking about that in McMinnville. But again, I'll be speaking a lot of places up in Oregon and Washington over a period of 10 days. Go to our website if you live up in that area, thenarrowpath.com. And look under announcements, and you'll see the places where I will be speaking in the next month. All right, let's talk next to Craig from, I believe, Craig, you're going to have to hold on a little bit because I think that, I'm not sure who's been there longest. I guess it is Craig. Craig, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. So my mom called me today, and she was doing her end of the life, and she's thinking about cremation. And my brother told her, oh, no, that's not biblical, because when the resurrection comes, you're going to be scattered. And I told her, I said, well, we're dust, and you can put scattered dust back together like the people in the Twin Towers. All those people are going to, the resurrection will be put back together again. And, you know, people that get eaten by sharks or whatever, that doesn't matter. So whether you're cremated or buried. And I was wondering, is there anything in the Bible that says that cremation isn't biblical?
No, there's nothing in the Bible that says that cremation isn't biblical. And you're thinking clearly. Your brother's not thinking as clearly. But your brother is thinking the way many Christians do. Many Christians do believe that cremation is not appropriate for Christians, and one of the reasons is the one he mentioned. They feel like the resurrection is somehow inhibited or compromised by reducing a dead body to ashes and perhaps scattering it over the ocean or over some field or something like that. How is God going to reassemble them? Well, as you said, lots of people have died in flames and their ashes have been blown all over the world, or died at sea, and they've been eaten by fishes, and so the atoms that were once their bodies are now in dozens of fishes, and then those fishes get eaten by other fishes, and then those get eaten by others. And eventually, if you die at sea, it's probable that the various atoms that were once part of your body are scattered all over the whole ocean. Most people have heard stories like this where, an apple tree in a church courtyard, from which people are eating apples, is found to have its roots having passed through a coffin and a corpse in the churchyard, so that the tree has been partially nourished from the the dead body of the corpse, and therefore some of the atoms of the corpse have gone into the tree and into the apples and into the people who've eaten the apples. And then, of course, when they die, they go elsewhere. One thing is very obvious to anyone who thinks this through is that if God knows how to raise the dead, he must know how to regather the necessary components, no matter what state they are in. Remember, he did make Adam from dust initially, and he told Adam, you'll be going back to dust. And even if you're not cremated, you do go back to dust. And that dust may be scattered. You may die in flames, and your ashes be blown all over the place, or you might die, and just deteriorate into dust, as everyone eventually does. So, how's God going to raise the dead? Well, I would say this, and many people have not thought very much about this, but how is it that your body that you have today is the same person that it was 20 years ago? You don't have any of the same cells in your body today that you had 20 years ago. All your body's cells are continually replacing themselves. You have all cells that are much newer than 20 years old. I don't know what the right number is. I've heard somewhere that every 7 years, your entire catalog is replaced. And if that is so, then what is it that makes you the same person? You don't have the same cells, the same atoms, the same molecules that you had. How are you the same person? Well, there's something else that makes you who you are. It's not the specific atoms of who you are. It's that which makes you an individual, which may, perhaps we could say, is your DNA. Of course, it may be something even spiritual besides the DNA, but the DNA is what all your cells, the ones you've lost, the ones you have now, have in common. Every cell in your body has the same DNA as the first zygote cell that was you when you were conceived in your mother's womb. It's that DNA that makes it you, and the cells can come and go as long as the DNA is there to produce more of you. And so all God really needs is the code. To put it in human terms, if God just has a big file folder somewhere with all the codes for every human being that's lived or died, or has it on a hard drive somewhere, of course he doesn't, he has it in his mind. But the point is, as long as he knows your code, he can bring you back. He can make all new cells. He doesn't need any of the dust that was once you. It'll still be you if it's the same DNA. Now, of course, there's even something more than DNA, because if, assuming you are raised from the dead and you have the same personality, you have memories, you have, a history, then there must be some other thing that creates continuity between your life in this world and the life in the resurrection. That would have to do with your mind in some respects. You will have memories. So there's more to it than just keeping all the cells. But if all the cells have to be gathered, God can gather them back. And if there's a few, not enough to go around, he can, cause a few more cells to be created to fill the gaps. But I'm speaking kind of lightheartedly here. I mean, the truth is, it's not a problem. Now, other Christians think that it's wrong because they think it's an indignity. Their concern is not about the resurrection. Their concern is about the indignity of burning a human body. The body's made in the image of God. The human body is. And, in our lifetime, we are the temple of the Holy Spirit. And therefore, one should not destroy the temple of the Holy Spirit. It's a sacrilege or something. Well, no doubt that's true while we are alive. But when we're dead, we are no longer the temple of the Holy Spirit. And though we were made in the image of God, we're now made in the image of Adam in the dust and decay quickly into a skeleton, which I don't know that the skeleton is itself so much in the image of God. I really don't think that the image of God in the body is as significant once it is dead until the resurrection. Once the life has left the body is just a piece of meat. I hate to be so crude. I know one person who listens to me whenever I talk about this, he thinks I'd speak too graphically about such things. But we live in the real world, okay? But the truth is, the person that we were, God knows who we were. God knows where to find us. God knows our code. He knows the numbers to put into the computer to regenerate our cells, if that's what it takes. I don't know what he does. But the point is, he can raise the dead, and there's nothing in the Bible that would suggest for a moment that cremation would be a problem to him in raising the dead. And again, many Christians died burning at the stake. Many Christians have been burned at the stake. Well, they were cremated even before they were dead. So, I mean, someone who's been burned up, it's, I guess they're just out of luck if God doesn't know how to put them back together again. But unlike all the king's horses and all the king's men, God definitely knows how to put us back together again when it's time. All right, I'm actually trying to activate the buttons on my screen. So that I wanted to actually hear some more from Craig here, but my screen is frozen. Okay, we've got a bit of a problem here. The link to the server is down. Okay, so I've just lost my whole connection to the studio. Clark, are you there? Are there still calls there?
Yes.
Okay, is Craig still there?
Yes.
Could you activate his call again for me? Because my computer connection went down. I will reopen it. Hi, Craig. You're back now. I'm sorry about the interruption there.
No problem. I appreciate your answer and your time.
All right. Is there anything else we can do for you?
No. I just had that question because my mom had called me this morning, and so I said, I'm going to call Steve, and then she can listen to it tonight.
Okay. Well, how do you think she'll take it? Is she a Christian?
Yes.
Okay.
She's considering cremation, and but then when she told my brother that, he said that wasn't biblical to do so. And
I see.
Because I brought up the Twin Towers, and she goes, I didn't even think about that. I said, I don't think there's anything in the Bible that would say anything against it.
Yeah, I think a lot of Christians don't think very thoroughly about these subjects until they're at the point where they're actually considering them. It actually has some relevance to their own decisions. All right. Well, Craig, I appreciate your call. And Clark, I'm still not connected. I tried to reconnect, but it didn't work. So who's this?
There's
Pam from Monterey, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Pam.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah, I just am not able to see on my screen that you're there. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is Pam from Monterey.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a question. I looked up a few scriptures, and I was looking for scriptures that tell about how we're all going to be caught up together to meet Jesus in the clouds. And I never found the word rapture, but I did find, like, in 1 Corinthians 15, and in 1 Thessalonians 4. And
right.
My question is, can you give us some scriptures that prove that we are going to meet him in the clouds?
Well, the two references you gave are the two references in the Bible on the subject. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 15 doesn't mention the clouds. It mentions that we will be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. This mortality will put on immortality. But this is talking about the rapture. Because he talks about how some who are dead, he said, the trump shall sound and the dead shall rise. Then we will be changed. So he makes a distinction between the dead and those who are not dead. But both the dead and the living at the time of Christ, if they're Christians, will be translated into the air to meet the Lord. Now, it's 1 Thessalonians 4 that gives the details about the clouds.
Yeah.
And that's where it says, you know, that the dead in Christ will rise first, which agrees with what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15. And then, secondly, those of us who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them to meet the Lord in the air, which is, you know, in the clouds, to meet them in the clouds. And thus we will ever be with the Lord. Those are the two passages that talk about it.
So because of that, those scriptures are pretty clear. How can someone that says they're a Christian not believe in the rapture?
Well, I'm not
sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there are very many Christians who don't believe in the rapture, but there are a lot of Christians who have different opinions about when the rapture occurs. This is, you know, the idea that there will be a rapture has never been very controversial in the church. Throughout church history, it's always been believed that there will be a day when Jesus returns and he raises the dead and the living saints will be caught up to meet the Lord in the air. But what has been controversial, especially since the 19th century, is, you know, when does the rapture occur with reference to other events? For example, the church always believed throughout history that the rapture occurs when Jesus actually returns on the last day. And Jesus said he'll raise his people up on the last day. And that was the view of the church. In the 19th century, another view arose that said, well, the rapture isn't going to happen on the last day. The rapture is going to happen 7 years before that. And that the last day will be a different event, that the rapture will happen first. Then 7 years later, there will be another coming of Christ, which they call the Revelation. So you've got the second coming of Christ in two phases, the rapture being the first and the Revelation being the second. And they are separated in the minds of some by a 7 year interval called the tribulation. Now, some people believe that interval is only half that long, about 3.5 years. And some even make it shorter than that, the people who hold the pre-wrath rapture. But all these people believe in a rapture. But you will find people who dispute when the rapture will be. And that you've been talking to people who deny that there's a rapture, or are they just denying a pre-tribulation rapture?
Yeah, I think my friend might be doing that, but this friend says they're a Christian, but they say that they don't believe in the rapture. And then, I don't argue about
what do they believe? What do they believe in place of the rapture? I mean, what do they think will happen when Jesus comes?
I said, well, what Bible are you reading? I said, have you not read the scriptures about in the twinkling of an eye we'll all be caught up? Mm-hmm. I said, are you reading a Bible that's from the Greek and the Hebrew? And then he went on to the thing about when it's going to happen. He jumped to that, and I wasn't really talking about when.
Okay.
He just said he didn't believe in the rapture.
Well, I think he may be a person who doesn't understand where the controversy is. He may have only met people in the past who believe in a pre-tribulation rapture. There's lots of churches that only preach that one view, a rapture before the tribulation. He may have concluded that that's not a biblical doctrine. And so when he says, I don't believe in the rapture, he might only know about one doctrine of the rapture, the pre-trib, and he might be saying, I don't believe in the pre-trib rapture.
Yeah,
he may not be very
knowledgeable
about, the theological controversies, and that'd be understandable. Lots of churches don't clarify them in their teaching. But, you should ask him, what does he think will happen when Jesus comes back? What does he think will happen to the living Christians,
not raptured? Yeah, I should ask him. He did mention the last day, and he thought the last day was when Jesus comes back, which it kind of sounded like was after the tribulation.
Yeah, well, it should be, I would think. If it's the last day, there wouldn't be any more days after that. And Jesus did say that he will raise his people up on the last day. So it's probable what your friend means. He doesn't believe that there will be a rapture that is separate from the second coming, like an earlier rapture. And if that's the only view he's heard at church, the pre-trib rapture, he may just be saying, I don't believe that.
Oh, okay. That makes sense, because I looked up a few other scriptures, and they talked about after the tribulation, God's going to come and gather, or Jesus will come and gather his elect.
Right. In Matthew 24, you find that, around verse 31 or so. Yeah,
Matthew, and then Mark 13, and then John 5. And I'm thinking that's different than the rapture, I'm thinking, because that's talking about his elect, and I'm thinking the elect are the ones that make it through the tribulation.
Well, I will say each passage would have to be taken case by case, to be sure, because not all the passages that are used to refer to the rapture are necessarily really about the rapture, but some of them are. Anyway, I appreciate your call, and we're out of time for today's program. God bless you, Pam.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are a listener-supported ministry. That means we pay for the time on the radio, and we depend on listeners to help us do that, or else we go off the air. We don't have deep pockets, but we have been on the air for 19 years daily because of listeners like you. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. It's also possible to donate from the website if you want to, where everything is free, many resources at thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.